Okay, so welcome everybody to our Sutta class. Today we are going to discuss or have a look at Majjhima Nikaya number 50, the Maratajaniya Sutta. And because this Sutta number 50 follows on from the amazing Brahmanimantika Sutta, and similarly the Maratajaniya has got a bit of a cosmic dimension to it, not your ordinary everyday sutta. This has three Chinese parallels, one of which occurs in the Majjhima Agama and two are individual translations. The individual translations, one of them was done by an unknown translator in the period between 25 and 220 AD. So it's quite a large period of time it could have been translated in, but that's quite an early period for translations into Chinese. And another one was translated by between 25 and 220. So that was like the first period of translations into Chinese. The other one by Zhi Qian. Is that right? Can we have pronunciation correction on that?
Zhi Qian.
Okay. It was translating between about 220 to 253 AD, so a little bit later. There's some interesting differences between the versions in this case. Okay, well, both of the individual translations took place among the Vajjians, whereas a Pali version and the Majjhima Agama version took place in the Bhaga country at Sungsumara Gira, is the Crocodile Mountain. Now, there are also quite a number of Sanskrit fragments for this particular sutta, and I won't go through all of the details of them, but there's no full suttas. There's very few, for the Majjhima, there's very few Sanskrit things available for some reason. We just haven't found much Sanskrit stuff in the Majjhima, and there's quite a lot of the Digha, quite a lot of the Samyutta, but not huge amounts of Majjhima, mostly just scraps and fragments. So again, we meet one of our favourite figures in Buddhist literature, Mara. One wonders whether it's more fun to meet him in the suttas than it would be to meet him in real life. How scary would it be? Suttas will do. Anyway, I found this is an article about Mara. This is from the Pali Dictionary of Proper Names. It gives us a bit more information, some of the things we were talking about last week. The personification of death, the evil one, the tempter. The legends concerning Mara are in the books very involved and defy any attempts at unravelling them. In the latest accounts, mention is made of five Maras. Okay, Kandha Mara, the Mara who's of the Kandhas. Kilesa Mara, Mara of the defilements. Abhisankara Mara, Mara of the, how do you translate Abhisankara, the resolution or intention, intentional Mara. How that's different from Kilesa Mara, I'm not quite sure. Matu Mara, Mara as death. And Devaputta Mara, Mara as a Deva. And he gives various quotes and references there to all of the different references and so on, both in the suttas and the paracanonical literature and also in the commentaries. So it's quite a useful collection of references there. And other ways, other places, there's mentions of three types of Maras, and he's three types, the Devaputta Mara, the Death Mara, and Defilement Mara. Sometimes five Maras are mentioned, sometimes four Maras are mentioned, and so on. And so there's no kind of particularly consistent thing there. In view of the many studies of Mara by various scholars already existing, it might be worthwhile here to attempt a theory of Mara in Buddhism, based chiefly on the above data. The commonest use of the word was evidently in the sense of death. From here it was extended to mean the world under the sway of death, also known as Maradheya, and the beings therein. Hence the Kilesas also came to be called Mara in that they were instruments of death, the causes enabling death to hold sway over the world. All temptations brought about by the Kilesas were likewise regarded as the work of death. So this movement from the subjective to the objective here. There was also evidently a legend of a Devaputta of the Vasavati world called Mara, who considered himself the head of the Kamavachara world, and who recognized any attempt to curb the enjoyment of sensual pleasures as a direct challenge to himself and to his authority. As time went on, these different conceptions of the word became confused one with the other, but this confusion is not always difficult to unravel. I'm not sure what he means there, whether he means it, this confusion is sometimes difficult to unravel, or anyway. Okay, so here's a few quotes from the suttas. Those who can restrain the mind and check its propensities can escape the snares of Mara. He who delights in objects cognizant via under Mara's A. He who has attachment is entangled by Mara. Mara will overthrow him who is unrestrained in his senses, immoderate in his food, idle and weak. By attaining the Noble Eightfold Path, one can be free from Mara. Okay. And then here in bits of conversation between Mara and the bhikkhuni Vajira, she attained arahantship and tells Mara, there is no being here, no satta, who can come under your control. There is no being but a mere heap of sankharas, suddha sankhara punja. So it's a very famous dialogue there between Mara and bhikkhuni Vajira. Okay, so then he goes on to talk about the later descriptions of the battle between the Buddha and Mara and so on, and all the forces of Mara and his elephant Girimekala. It's in the Girimekala in the one of the chants that we do. Followers assuming fearsome shapes and all kinds of weapons of mass destruction and so on, and they come and attack him and all this kind of stuff. So anyway, obviously he defeats them. Malalasekara is the author of this Pali Dictionary Common Names. His comment on this is that this account of the Buddha's struggle with Mara is literally true. None but the most ignorant of the Buddhists believe, even at the present day. The Buddhist point of view has been well expressed by Rhys Davids, where to understand by the attack of Mara's forces that all the Buddha's old temptations came back upon him with renewed force. For years that all earthly good through the deception carried within itself the seeds of bitterness and was altogether worthless and impermanent. But now, to his wavering faith, the sweet delights of home and love, the charms of wealth and power, began to show themselves in a different light and glow again with attractive colours. He doubted and agonized in his doubt, but as the sun set, the religious side of his nature had won the victory and seems to have come out even purified from the struggle.
Why have we not heard this before?
What?
It's a quote from someone else.
This second lot of temptation.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well, it hasn't occurred in any sutta
reference. Oh, yeah, the temptation, this, the particular description of the Mara's attack by the army, the Buddha's, the attack by Mara's army on the Buddha, is only kind of elaborated in the later texts, although there are some things about it in some of the earlier texts, but actually the most detail is in the early texts, is in the Sutta Nipata, which we haven't done a lot of readings from here, but there's actually a story there, which is very nice actually, and
I thought there was only the one temptation under the Bodhi tree.
There is. Which one's the second one that you're talking about?
This one. Old temptations came back.
Oh yeah, but this is the old temptations are referring to when he was living in lay life.
Well, that's the second temptation.
The last temptation of the Buddha. It's just an attempt at an interpretation, that's all.
So what's this guy's point here at the moment? Is that Mara is it saying that the most ignorant of Buddhists? What is that?
The most ignorant of Buddhists believe that the story of the, you know, the literal story of the attack of the army and so on is literally true.
No so, one believes that.
So that's what he's saying, yeah. So,
In that list of, it says the divisions are as follows. Gautama refers to Mara's army as being tenfold. I missed it. Was that all the first five hindrances?
No, there's a specific list of Mara's army, tenfold army, which is originally found in the Sutta Nipata, and yeah.
He doubted and agonized in his doubt.
He wasn't a Buddha then. He's a Bodhisattva. Okay, so obviously what we're so here's the list of the 10 armies taken from the Padahana Sutta of the Sutta Nipata. Lust, aversion, hunger and thirst, craving, sloth and indolence, cowardice, doubt, hypocrisy and stupidity, gains, fame, honour and glory, and lording of oneself and condemning of others. Need a bit of a spell checker there, but lording of oneself and condemning of others. Okay, so obviously what the issue is that Buddhism is a very internal religion, okay? And so it's always depicting spiritual life as being something that now practice mind and being impermanence and all of these kinds of things. And it's not always easy to convey these. Like, how do you actually communicate? Well, in ancient times, of course, the way that they would do that was through myth, through storytelling, through legend, and through mentions there all the artworks. So, of course, all these amazing artworks of the Buddhas and the attack by Mara, which you've probably seen in various kinds of places, and they're quite very detailed and go into quite gore and so on, all the demons and monsters and everything. And so this is the way that this was made vivid and brought alive for people. Okay, so
the problem with interpreting Mara as purely psychological is that, well, then later on during the course of the Buddha's life, then Mara is meant to come to the Buddha and say things like, "Oh, you should take parinibbana now," and things like that. So that would say that he is still subject to temptation. So if you say that it's purely psychological, then you fall into that problem of the Buddha is kind of not really fully enlightened to this domestic.
So was it fully psychological, purely psychological? That's not what he's saying here. Obviously, yes, that's correct. And it started out by saying there are psychological aspects and then real aspects as well. The problem is that the problem is not in Buddhism. The problem is the attempt to impose non-Buddhist modes of understanding on Buddhism, which makes a kind of radical difference between the psychological sphere and ontological sphere. So you say if it's psychological, then the ontology doesn't exist. Whereas from a Buddhist point of view, comes from exactly the opposite point of view, is saying that ontology is actually generated by psychology. So the very fact that we have Mara in our minds is what generates Mara as a rebirth. Okay. And so Mara, as a Devaputta, is nothing more than the ontological expression, if you like, of Mara as a defilement. Okay, so there's not like the gulf between those two things. And this is the problem with that kind of argument, is it reads a gulf between these two things, which is just not Buddhism.
Could you say that I did remember ontology from university, but I actually have forgotten it. Could you say what you just said?
In English, what does ontology mean? Future exercise. No, nothing to do with onts. It's the study of onts. Anyone want to attempt a definition of ontology? That's a different meaning. The study of being, right? Study of the ultimate nature of things. Study the broadest range of categories of existence, which also has questions about the existence of particular kinds of objects, such as numbers or moral facts. Okay? So, for example, do numbers exist? Yeah. And what does it mean? Really, what ontology means is, at the most basic level, it means what does it mean when we say something is? That's what ontology is. The study of being and what constitutes objective and subjective existence and what it means to exist. Okay? So that's pretty much in the sense that I was using it in just now. The study of being and what constitutes objective and subjective existence and what it means to exist.
What were you saying? That there was an existence out of the mind, and not to confuse it with the internal... Is that what you're saying? Not to confuse it with the kalesas that are produced within the mind?
Uh-huh.
The kalesas produced in the mind are, you can't separate it internal and external.
No. The kalesas, kind of, yes. The kalesas produced in the mind are what create the world, yeah? So, manopubangama dhamma, the mind is the creator, the mind is the creative force in the universe, yeah? So if you have Mara as defilements, and this is abhisankara especially, in here, the first one, abhisankara literally means a creative force. That's what abhisankara means, creative force. So Mara in the mind is a creative force, and then that's doing kama. Abhisankara is just a synonym for kama. And that's doing kama, and that creates beings getting reborn in this and that state. So that's why if we have a mind state which is like a deva, then we get reborn as a deva. If we have a mind state like a yaka, we get reborn as a yaka. If we have a mind state like a mara, we get reborn as a mara. Yeah. So that doesn't, like, discussion of is there a heaven and a hell and objective worlds and things like that, that doesn't prove that anything like that exists, right? All it shows is that the ways that, from a psychological point of view, a tendency within a psychological framework to reduce to merely psychology, okay, is not actually justified by the Buddhist framework. Okay, so to say that yes, there is an internal Mara, and say therefore there isn't an external Mara, that kind of logic doesn't apply within Buddhism. Okay, all that means, because the external world is conditioned and being produced and created by the internal world on a constant back and forth. So there's no either or in Buddhism. Okay, in fact, it seems to me, what the surprising thing seems to me is, why aren't there more Maras? Seems to me that if Mara is going to be produced, well, there should be billions of them, or we should be swarming in them.
Well, we are.
Maybe we are. I don't know. So this is the thing with Mara as subjective and objective. You know, from a Buddhist point of view, we should never feel uncomfortable or inauthentic in looking at Mara as a psychological problem. Okay, that's not an issue. What's an issue is the psychological reductionism and saying because it's in the mind, therefore it's nothing else. So that's a philosophical philosophical problem, not an empirical or a psychological problem. Okay, all right. So
could you call it like the shadow part of it?
Yeah, yeah. That's another aspect or another way of thinking about it, for sure.
Well, if you looked at it from the positive viewpoint, you have like the Brahma Viharas,
mm-hmm.
right? But he's in the mind, but you still have external Brahmas.
Oh, yeah, sure, exactly the same. Yeah, exactly the same.
Why would the Mara come to the Buddha?
Well, because he's afraid. He's afraid that...
of being subdued.
Sorry?
Mara is afraid of being subdued by the Buddha.
Yeah, yeah, the Buddha's going to get him. Yeah, or many beings are going to escape from his his conscience. Okay, back to Malalasekara. I should finish this article off here. So without going to all, he gives most of the references and so on to Mara. Now here is his actual theory here, which I'm just put out just to see whether it's true or not. Can it be that with the accounts of Mara as a personification of evil came to be mixed legends of an actual Devaputta, named Mara, also called Vasavati, because he was an inhabitant of the Paramita Vasavati Deva world. Already in Anguttara Nikaya, Mara is described as the head of those enjoying bliss in the Kamavatara world and as a Dharmarika Devaputta. What's a Dharmarika? I'm not sure what it means. Even after the Buddha's death, Mara was regarded as wishing to obstruct good works. Can it be that ancient legends represented him as looking on with disfavor at the activities of the Buddha? That seems pretty obvious. So his idea is that there was a real personage designated as Mara Devaputta, okay, whether as a deva or a human, I'm not sure, but it seems to mean as a deva, and was later confused with the allegorical Mara. Okay, so this is Malalasekara's theory here. That there were originally two aspects or two quite separate things. One was an old Indian tradition of a deva of some kind called Mara, and then there was the development of this idea of Mara as death and temptation, and they got confused in later times. This is his theory here. Personally, I don't find it particularly plausible. It seems to me much more likely it's the other way around, that you start out with the Mara as a Devaputta is a more primitive kind of conception, or kind of animist conception, and then was later on given psychological and so on readings and dimensions, rather than the other way around. Okay? And then various other of the synonyms or names of Mara. Ganha means blackie. Okay, it's Mara, you don't have to be politically correct, alright? Adhipati, the Lord. Antaka, terminator. That's what it means, terminator. Namuchi, Namuchi means. Pamatta Bandhu, the kinsman of negligence, and so on. He's called Namuchi because none can escape him. Okay.
So Kali.
Yeah, he's related to Kali. He's called Kanha, and he came with his swarthy host. Okay, so there's obviously a bit of kind of racist stuff going on in here, kind of association, and that goes back to a very ancient time in India, and it's not 100% sure, but one interpretation of it is that harks back to the Aryan invasion or immigration or whatever period, when you had fairer skinned peoples moving into India, and that they kind of discriminated against the black and anasika, noseless original inhabitants. So this is kind of dimly recalled in a very few verses in the Rig Veda. And so whether that's, so the typically the Aryans is more fair skinned, and they sort of ejected the indigenous inhabitants out, and so they became more marginalized living in the forests and things like that. Whether that's actually historically true or not is debated. Okay? So Maratadaniya Sutta. Thus have I heard. On one occasion, the Venerable Mahamoggallana was living in the Bhagga country at Sungsumara Gira at the Behesakala Grove, the Deer Park. Oh, sorry, yeah, sorry, you mentioned Kala. I should have said, sorry, come back to that. But there, yeah. his missus, I think, or his mother, is Kali. Kali also meaning, well, Kali means black, but also means time. Okay? Mother of Mara. So there's quite a few.
It was just like destruction, or that re-energizing force of Kali.
Well, there's Kali. Kali's a kind of a name, isn't it? So it gets used a few different times. But the meaning of it is both time and black, the basic meaning of it. And so there's many different. It's interesting that it seems to have been used as just a name, Kali. We've had Kali the maid, okay, who was a naughty maid, right? So anything from a naughty maid up to anyone, and these just different meanings. The actual, the Kali, the developed goddess of Kali from later Hinduism, doesn't seem to have been explicitly known at the time of the Buddha, although there's references to figures who remind us of that. For example, Kali, a cremetrix. Okay, that's a good word, isn't it? Yes, one step further. Cremetrix of Savatthi. Seeing Mahakala, presumably it might, but also Mahakala being the name for Mara, or like the demon who's holding the black demon who holds the wheel of dependent origination in the Tibetan things, he's called Mahakala. Great time. Meditating in the cemetery, she cut off from a recently cremated body its thighs and arms, and making of them a sort of milk bowl, placed it near where the terror sat.
That's
the terror guitar. Yeah. Okay. So this particular reference is perhaps the earliest reference to a devotee of Kali in the later sense that we understand Kali of being the kind of the, you know, the black goddess who goes around drinking blood and so on. And then Kali the Yakini. Typical Yakini story in Buddhism. A householder having a barren wife married another woman, a friend of the former. Every time a child was conceived, the first wife brought about a miscarriage. At last, the second wife died through a miscarriage, and on her deathbed vowed to take her revenge after several births in which each alternatively devoured the children of the other. So there's all these motifs in these Buddhist legends of child sacrifice and this kind of devouring aspect of the mother and the mother goddess, which is a very kind of primitive level of kind of religious practice or religious conception. The second wife became an ogress named Kali, and the first wife was born into a good family twice. I don't know how she managed to get born into a good family after she'd been eating the other one's children all these times, but anyway, twice the ogress ate the latter's children. On the third occasion, Kali was occupied in Vesavana's service and the child was left unhurt, Vesavana being the Lord of the Yuccas. On his naming day, the parents looked into a jetty one, and there, as the mother was giving suck to her child while the husband bathed in the monastery pool, she saw the ogress. Interesting kind of picture, little picture there. The parents looked into a jetty one, mother was breastfeeding the child, and the husband was bathing in the monastery pool. I wonder quite what was going on there. What was he doing? Did they go to the monastery for a bath? If you go to the jetty one, has anyone been to the jetty one?
Yeah?
Huge big tanks there, yeah? Yeah, there's huge artificial ponds have been constructed there. So the idea that he was bathing there is certainly very reasonable. I mean, it's kind of funny when you look there, you know, you go there and there's this, it's like an Olympic swimming pool, right? These tanks. And then they say, oh, yeah, this is where the monks used to have their bath. And you think, well, you can certainly have a bath in there, but it's perhaps a little bit excessive. So whether they're actually part of the original monastery complex or not, I'm not sure. But whether they had some kind of ritual usage or something like that, I mean, why were the monasteries providing a service for people to come along and bathe in them? I don't know.
Indian cultures kind of purifying thing.
Purifying thing, yeah. So maybe they used to do that. They'd come along and do a bathe to purify themselves. She saw the ogress being terrified, dashed into the monastery where the Buddha was preaching. The guardian deity, Deva, Sumana, prevented Kali's entrance. So in those days they had, you know, you had to have a Deva standing by the front gate, stopping the yakas coming in. But the Buddha, having heard the story, sent for Kali and preached to her, whereupon she became a Sotapanna. The Buddha persuaded the two men to become friends, and Kali lived in the house of the other. But being uncomfortable there and at various other lodgings provided for her, she ultimately lived outside the village. There her aid was invoked for the protection of the crops, and 8 ticket foods, Salakabhata, were established in her honour. Again, very, very typical of the career arc of yakas and yakinis within Buddhism, starting out as a child-eating monster, becoming converted, becoming a stream mentorer, and then being a fertility deity who's adopted within the Buddhist tradition and invoked for protection of the crops, specifically in this case. Often it's mentioned that they also become a patron of childbirth, of course these being the two principal aspects of fertility, which are in primitive religions, protection of the crops and childbirth. And so this is... ticket foods. Again, it's kind of related to the crops thing. Yeah. So the Sangha is the field of merit. Yeah. So you, by offering to the Sangha and making this offering on behalf of the Sangha, then of course you're reaping the great fruits and so on. So this is also part of the whole fertility thing. So this is how the more animistic and primitive religious strata within Indian society were adopted within the Buddhist fold. What do they do with them?
Stand in
line. What are the tickets?
Oh, right. I think it's one of the means. In the Vinaya, it talks about different ways that meals can be offered. And I think with the Salakabhata, the idea was that you'd bring along a bunch of Salaka is like a tally stick, yeah. And so you'd get that, and I think it would be distributed at random to the monks and or nuns, and then they would get the invitation for the meal that day.
Because I've seen it mentioned before about the food tickets.
Yeah, yeah. It was a way of rostering and dealing out the things. Because if you didn't have the tickets, you could say so-and-so, go to the food diner, but then other monks or nuns are feeling a bit peckish, maybe show up, and then they say, well, hang on, you know, you were invited, and they say, oh, yeah, I was invited, and so it can be a bit embarrassing. So if you actually have the tickets, then it's like a way of guaranteeing who gets it. It's just one of the ways they had of distributing food. Hmm. I mean, and the advantage for the Sangha was that, you know, on those occasions, you would just go to a house. Or I'm not sure if Salakabhata would be offered in the monastery, possibly. It might be offered in the monastery sometimes, or gone to a house. But you just go to the house and have the meal, which would be prepared for you, and come back, rather than having to just wander around at random until you get enough on your arms wrapped. So it would be a bit of a treat to get that. Yeah. Okay. So it's a bit of a detour into the history of Kali worship in Buddhism.
In a way, it's the feminine version of Angulimala.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah. And precisely that, you should, in this book up there called How Buddhism Began by Richard Gombrich, and he's got the best article in there. It's a fantastic article about Angulimala, and he argues that that's exactly what Angulimala was. He was a devotee of Shiva in his sort of dark aspect. And he was sort of going around wearing the fingers and these kinds of things. And this Kali was the other example of that happening in that time. Apart from these two mentions, there's no mention of any of those kinds of practices in the time of the Buddha. Okay? So we don't have any evidence of them until much later. So traditionally they say they evolved later, although to me, to my way of thinking, they're obviously come from a very, very primitive kind of level of religious practice, of sacrifice, and all of this gory stuff happens in all, you know, very primitive religions. So it probably was around for years, but maybe we just don't have evidence of it. So you have this story of Angulimala as a kind of Brahmin student who had to sort of kill X amount of people to you know, work off his debt to his Brahmin teacher. But there's just so many gaping holes in that story, as Gombrich has shown. There's so many inconsistencies between the different accounts and so on, and it doesn't really explain the main details of the Angulimala story, so it's almost certainly an invention.
Is the Kali Yuga much later, or does it have sort of...
Apart from these mentions, it's only...
In commentary, is that right?
No, this is the Kali... She's mentioned in the Theragata. So you've just got a short mention there.
Only one sort of...
Like one line or a couple of lines, you know? I used to meditate constantly in the cemetery and so. There's just a couple of lines, it's just a hint.
So it's a later commentarial development that happened over converting people who were sacrificed.
The yakini things, yeah. There are a couple of things in like Sagata Wagga and so on that are a little bit similar. But yeah, that theme of specifically the child sacrificing deity, this is just one, and I mentioned it the other week. We've got Hariti and Kunti and many others who have similar stories.
There's Akali from the prison sutra.
That's right, yeah.
And there was the statues of these yakinis found in Buddhist monasteries.
Right, yeah, very, very widespread. Everywhere from Ajanta, probably Sri Lanka, I guess, and through to Japan. We should have a few. What do you reckon? Certainly spice up the monastery, wouldn't it?
That was a conversion tool, is that right?
I hope so. You know, hopefully it wasn't anything darker. Anyway, here we go. So far. Right, now it's nearly an hour's up and we've got through the first paragraph. Now, on that occasion, Venerable Mahamoggallana was walking up and down in the open, doing walking meditation. So this is the Jhangkamati. Okay. Being a desiderative reduplication. I'm sure you all want to find out about that particular little form. And there you go. Then on that occasion, Tenako Panasamayena. Now on that occasion, Samaya being an occasion, Mara, the evil one, of the Venerable Mahamoggallana's Kuchi, he was gone. Okay? So, and entered his bowels. Okay? Okay, so kuchi gato, kuchi, the belly. Right. And the Venerable Mahamoggallana considered thus, why is my belly so heavy? Kinnu ko me kuchi king. What or why? Kinnu ko, question particle, ko, indeed. Me means me, mine. Kuchi, belly. Garu garo. Okay. Heavy, heavy. Why is my belly heavy, heavy? Via meaning like or just like masa chitang, beans. Okay,
it's
full of beans.
Early on as well.
Really? It's an indication of the ancient Indian love of dal, I guess. Just like a belly full of beans. Then he left the walk and went into his dwelling, where he sat down on a seat made ready. Okay. When he had sat down, he gave thorough attention to himself. Not perhaps the best translation in that particular context. Here we go, where is he? Pachatang yoniso inside. Pachatang, obviously meaning inside his body in this case. Pachatang yoniso manasakasi. So use some kind of his meditation abilities to investigate inside his body and what's going. And he saw that Mara, the evil one, had gone into his belly and had entered his bowels. When he saw this, he said, "Come out, evil one. Come out, evil one. Do not harass the Tathagata, do not harass the Tathagata's disciple, or it will lead to your harm and suffering for a long time." Okay? Nikkama. Get out. Okay? So here we have an example of, we talked a little bit a week or two ago about the past tense being called the aorist form, and I mentioned that the aorist is not always past tense, but is sometimes also used in the sense of a prohibition or an order. Okay? So in which case it doesn't have any past tense implications. So here we have an aorist form, ahosi, and ma te ahosi. Do not, okay? Do not do not do what will be for a long time for your suffering. Okay? And then ma, do not hassle. Vihesesi. Okay? So this is this usage, always in connection with this particle ma, meaning don't. Right? Then Mara, the evil one, thought, this recluse does not know me. He does not see me when he says that. Even his teacher would not know me for so soon. How can this disciple know me? So, obviously, Mara's in a bit of denial here. Then the Venerable Moggallana said, even thus I know you, evil one. Do not think he does not know me. You are Mara, the evil one. You are just thinking thus, evil one. This recluse does not know me. He does not see me when he says that. Even his teacher would not know me so soon. So how can this disciple know me? Then Mara, the evil one, thought, the recluse knew me. He saw me when he said that. And thereupon he came up from the Venerable Mahamoggallana's mouth and stood against the door bar. Okay? So, certainly seems fairly real, concrete. You know, he's not an idea flying out of Mahamoggallana's mouth. He's obviously a being of some sort. Mukato, uggantwa, Mara coming. You'd do a great version of that with some CGI, couldn't you? Mahamoggallana and Mara coming out and then leaning against the doorpost, feeling pretty casual about all of this kind of stuff. Right. Then Moggallana saw him standing there and they said, I see you too there, evil one. Do not think he does not see me. You're standing against the door bar, evil one. So he's just like, you know, hasn't got a hope. It happened once, evil one, that I was a Mara named Dusi and I had a sister named Kali. You were her son, so you were my nephew. Okay, so before we were asking whether Kali was the mother or the sister of Mara, of course she's both. Right, so both the mother and the sister. And again, this is a classic symptom of early and primitive religions, and especially mother symbolism in early primitive religion, where the mother is the wife and also the sister and also the all of these kinds of things, and it's all mixed up. Okay, and so this is like an expression of a very a time when these roles were not differentiated and not clearly known, which could be both an expression or a memory, a cultural memory of a time in society before the different roles had been delineated, and can also be understood in terms of a psychological development of being a memory of a time within human development before we've clearly differentiated these kinds of roles. Okay, but this is Mahamoggallana speaking. Yeah, but this is very, very common. Okay, in mythology, very, very common. This mix up of the mother and the sister and things like that. Isis and so many of the others are all in the same
kind of thing. That's why it's so confusing when you read this stuff. It's just, you know, they're everything. And then they were this and then they were that as well. It's just like... Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I sort of get a bit lost and sort of think, okay, right.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty, you know, reasonable kind of reaction, you know. Yeah. Actually, I mean, the reason I was just saying this, I've just been reading, there's a classic book by Neumann called The History of Consciousness, and there's just the passages I've just been reading about it, it's been talking about precisely this. So if you want some stuff on that, it's talking about in the psychological dimension of these things, yeah, then it's very interesting. Yeah. So, okay, now on that occasion, the Blessed One Kakusandha, accomplished and fully enlightened, had appeared in the world. So this is an era of the Buddha Kakusandha, who was one of the previous Buddhas, not the immediate previous Buddha, who was Kassapa. Which one was Kassapa? How far back was Kakusandha?
Kassapa was the first Buddha to arise in his present cosmological cycle called the auspicious age.
He was
followed by the Buddhas Konan Brahmana and Kassapa, after whom the present Buddha arose.
Okay, very good. So beginning of this eon, and interesting. I mean, we have this kind of idea that the you know, disciples and Buddhas have been developing their baramis for so many years, but here we have Mahamoggallana, the second great disciple, who's even relatively short time ago, in this scheme of things, is not only not particularly well developed. He's actually Mara. You couldn't think of much more of an inauspicious start than that. Now.
Yeah, but how many billion years ago was that?
It was quite a few. But in terms of like the careers of the bodhisattvas and things, like one eon is like...
The teaching's the same, gone to the root of the tree.
Yeah, Yeah, it doesn't change the teachings. Yeah. This is the problem. That's why there's no point in waiting for Maitreya to come along. He's going to tell you the same thing anyway. Now, Vasubandhu Kakusandha, accomplished and fully enlightened, had an auspicious pair of chief disciples named Vidhura and Sanjiva. Among all the disciples of the Blessed One Kakusandha, accomplished and fully enlightened, there was none equal to the Venerable Vidhura in teaching the Dhamma. This is how he came to have the designation Vidhura. Okay? The name meaning the unrivaled. Interesting that slightly different way of describing the chief disciples than we're used to. We have the foremost in wisdom, foremost in psychic powers in our Buddha, but here it's the foremost in teaching. Sounds a bit more like Ananda, perhaps. Anyway. But the Venerable Sanjiva, gone to the forest or the root of a tree or an empty hut, entered without difficulty upon the cessation of perception and feeling. Of course, being the meditative state we discussed in the Maha and Chula Vedala suttas. So it's interesting that there's the two aspects, you know. One of them is obviously, this is like the kind of the Bodhisattva and the Arahant, isn't it? You know, one of them's going out there and teaching and helping beings, and the other one's just going off and doing their meditation. So they're both of them found there. It happened once, evil one, that the Venerable Sanjiva had seated himself at the root of a certain tree and entered upon the cessation of perception and feeling. Some cowherds, shepherds, ploughmen and travellers saw Sanjiva sitting there, and they thought, "It is wonderful, sirs, it is marvellous. This recluse died while sitting. Let us cremate him." Then the cowherds, shepherds, ploughmen and travellers collected grass, wood and cow dung, and having piled it up against the Venerable Sanjiva's body, they set fire to it and went on their way. Now, evil one, when the night had ended, the Venerable Sanjiva emerged from that attainment. He shook his robe, and then, it being morning, he dressed, and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went to the village for alms. The cowherds, shepherds, ploughmen and travellers saw the Venerable Sanjiva wandering for alms, and they thought, "It is wonderful, sirs, it is marvellous. This recluse who died while sitting has come back to life." That was how the Venerable Sanjiva came to have the designation Sanjiva, means living. And jiva being the word for life, and same as jivaka.
Pretty interesting. You can burn someone while they're in attainment realm, and they come out without being touched.
Yeah. Well, that's. Yeah. Certain kinds of attainments are supposed to give that kind of thing. There's a bit of a discussion on the different versions here. The Chinese renderings says here they didn't seem to be aware of the meaning of Sanjiva. So the Madhyama Agama version has his name as being.
How do you pronounce that?
Xiang. Xiang. Perception or thinking. So, and this one?
Zixiang.
Knowing perception. Okay, even though there's no relation, you can see that the forms, especially the Sanskrit forms of those words, look a little bit similar. But obviously a bit of a mistake by the translator, yeah. And here we have Sanjiva as
Saroa,
meaning
Nirvana.
Sorry?
Sa means Bodhisattva.
Is that translation by the Sa or something like that?
Transliteration.
Transliterating. And this one?
Huansen.
Huan
means return.
Return.
Life again. So
born again.
Sanjiva is sun. Sun has the meaning of like awake again, or
not literally. No, not literally. What does have that meaning is pati sanjivita, where the pati means reborn, resurrected. So sanjiva doesn't literally mean that, but you know, it could have that meaning in that context. Now, sanjiva just means like with life, really. Okay, and then the bit of a discussion on the different kinds of attainments, meditation states that Sanjiva might have been in. Now, this particular part of the sutta also has a parallel in the Ekotara Agama, as well as the other versions that we've seen. And the Ekotara Agama says that Sanjiva didn't get cessation, but diamond concentration. According to the Sutil, is a Chinese dictionary, the last stage of the Bodhisattva, characterized by firm, indestructible knowledge, penetrating all reality, attained after all remains of illusion have been cut off. So this is Vajra Samadhi, or Vajira Samadhi. Now this gives the explanation according to the Chinese tradition. I do believe, though, that the term Vajra Samadhi was possibly invented by the Sarvasivadins, if I'm not entirely mistaken, and may have originally meant lightning samadhi, the words for lightning and diamond being the same. But there's a sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya where it talks about the knowledge realization being like a flash of lightning in the dark night. Yeah, so you have this flash, so it's like lightning concentration. Yeah, that's maybe where it came from originally, used by the Sarvasivadins in their own scheme, and then adopted by the Mahayanas to mean this diamond concentration.
Funny, but in Chinese, when we say diamond or samadhi, means cannot defeat it.
Cannot defeat it. Yeah.
Because diamond is so strong, so that kind of samadhi.
Yeah.
Never been defeated.
Yeah. So this is why when the yaka comes along and hits Sariputra on the head, he's also got diamond concentration. Yeah. So if you hit diamonds, then it doesn't break. Okay, so the commentary records various opinions on Sariputta's meditative attainment at the moment of being hit by the yaka. One of which, this is the kind of thing that monks like to sit around and argue about. One of which is that he attained cessation. Hence, it might be possible that the expression diamond concentration does not yet have its later meaning as a referent to the last state of the Bodhisattva, but refers indeed to the attainment of cessation, perhaps.
Does that have anything to do with the Zen business of giving you a whack?
Maybe, I never thought of that. yeah, it could be. Oh, and wonders, yeah. And then another parallel to the Maratajaniya Sutta talks about form, image, concentration, attainment.
How do you say that?
So perhaps we might simply accept that it's not always easy to know exactly what stage of meditation attainment that these yogis might have been in. Yes. Okay. Anyway, whatever he was sitting in, it must have been pretty good, I reckon. So that's all. I'm happy with that. Okay. Now, evil month. The Mara Dusi considered that. So Dusi means corrupter. That's what Dusi means. Right? There are these virtuous bhikkhus of good character, but I do not know their coming or their going. Okay? So I don't know what they're about, or I don't understand them. Right? Sometimes used as an expression for like you don't know where they're going to be reborn, you don't know what their destiny is. Okay, so Mara wants to know, that he's going to keep them in his control, but he's not sure where they're going to be going. Let me now take possession of these Brahmin householders. The Anvavi Seyang seems to mean taking possession of. Now we found this already in the Brahmanimantika Sutta recently, and we noticed that in that sutta there was some variation between the Pali and Chinese versions about whether Mara was actually taking possession or whether he was merely like speaking or influencing. And we find the same kind of variation here. And Varanalia discusses that. In the Pali version he says take possession. According to the Chinese versions, he only instructed the householders to act according to his design. Okay? So in the Pali and the Chinese versions agree that the householders had to suffer rebirth in hell for their behavior towards the monks. In the light of this retribution, the Pali version's proposal that Mara took possession of the householders is puzzling. When Analo says it's puzzling, it means he doesn't believe it, okay? Since one would not expect the householders to undergo the karmic retribution of being born in hell for something they had not done of their own accord. Okay, so that seems fair enough. Yeah. And there's some more on that a bit later on. All right. Now, let me take possession of these Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, abuse, revile, scold, and harass the virtuous bhikkhus of good character. Then, perhaps, when they are abused, reviled, scolded, and harassed by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Maradusi may find an opportunity. So he's going to keep them trapped in samsara. So, where's the abuse thing here? Okay. Akosiyamana, paribhasiyamana, rosiyamana, vihesiyamana. Okay. So this is akosata, paribhasata. This is the standard words to abuse or revile. As, for example, in the Garudama saying that bhikkhunis are not allowed to abuse and revile the bhikkhus. Obviously here referring to, not merely saying, Venerable Sir, could you not take all of the chocolate cake or something like that? Something a bit stronger than that. Okay. Now, and then Maradusi did take possession of them and told them to abuse the monks. Then when he'd taken possession of them, they did abuse, revile, scold, and harass the virtuous because of good behavior. Thus, these bald-pated recluses, these swarthy, menial offspring of the kinsman's feet, claim, we are meditators, and with shoulders drooping and heads down and all limp, they meditate, premeditate, outmeditate, and mismeditate. Just as an owl on a branch waiting for a mouse meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates, or just as a jackal on a riverbank waiting for fish, or as a cat waiting for a mouse by an alley or a drain or a rubbish bin, or as a donkey unladen standing by a doorpost or a dustbin or a drain, meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates. So too these bald-pated recluses, these swarthy, menial offspring of the kinsman's feet, claim, we are meditators, and with shoulders drooping, heads down, and all limp, they meditate, premeditate, outmeditate, and mismeditate. Right. So here, interesting kind of perspective on the kind of attitudes which might have been held towards the monks and so on. So when they're saying that they're meditators, they're jhayino sma. Okay. So the word for meditation all the way through here is jhana. Okay. Or the same root as jhana. And then when it says meditate, mismeditate, demeditate, remeditate, and so on, then this is just jhayanti, okay? They jhana in the verbal form with a series of prefixes, okay? None of the prefixes meaning anything particularly, right? Although generally they kind of intensify. They're often used for a word like to brood or contemplate something or something like that. So this is what the jhana. So this is an interesting passage from a context of what is the root meaning or basic meaning of jhana in a kind of non-meditation and non-technical sense. And just like an uluka, okay, which is a owl, probably being a but being a Indo-European root, one would imagine, ul, owl, sounding a lot like owl, ruka, standing on the tree branch, musikang, seeing the mousy, okay, and waiting, and then meditates and so on and so forth. So what's the owl doing meditating? What does it mean? Does it mean sitting there watching its breath going in and out, or what exactly does it mean when it's saying the owl is meditating here?
Sitting quietly watching for the mouse.
Hmm. It's quite good samadhi, doesn't it? Sits very quietly, doesn't move, watching. Why does it watch?
In order to catch,
yeah.
So it's not right jhana then, because it doesn't have right view.
It's not right view, but it gives you like an implication of the meaning of it. Like it's very intent watching, but with a great sense of balance, isn't it? There's this total commitment to it, because your life depends on it. If the owl doesn't watch properly, they're not going to eat and they're going to die. So there's a total commitment to just watching.
When in the jhana, It wouldn't be aware of the external world.
Well, that's right. I don't think the owl's going to actually go into jhanas.
It might get the mouse casino.
Yeah, it could do. Yeah, could do. And the same with the jackal. Where's what the owl? And we've got, where's the jackal on the... Seyatavinama totu. The jackal. Naditire mache. Okay, watching the fish.
This is like Ajahn talking about the chicken, where anyone can be... A chicken just sits there.
Mm-hmm.
So if you just sit,
mm-hmm.
Well then it's just like a chicken.
Sitting on the eggs?
Yeah, just sitting there.
Right. Like a vilara, cat. Okay. Also watching for the mouse.
It can be sort of looking around as well. The chicken need not necessarily be.
But she's committed to warming her eggs.
Yeah, but she can look around and her mind need not be on the chicken.
Speaking from experience.
There is.
And the poor old Musika gets a bit of a hard time here. It's being eaten by the cats and the owls. And then the donkey, unladen Gadrabha. Gadrabha, also being a name of a child-eating yucca. The donkey monster. But here... Venerable Analio again gives a bit of an explanation here. The Chinese, well, the Paramahansa says the donkey is standing by the doorpost. This image is not entirely clear, since one may wonder what the object of the donkey's meditation could be, all the more since a donkey is not a predatory animal, unlike the other animals mentioned before. The Chinese versions provide the detail required to fill out this image, all three versions agreeing that the object occupying the donkey's mind at the end of a hard day's work, his meditation object, as it were, is food or fodder. Okay? So in all these cases, your meditation is food. Yeah? That has certain implications which we might leave. Okay. And then on that occasion, when most of these human beings, when they died, reappeared in the dissolution of the body after death, in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destination, in perdition, even in hell. Okay, so can you go to hell for yelling at the monks, even when Mara's taken over your mind?
Well, it says here.
But then it's already pointed
out. Well, chances are you most probably could, because you shouldn't have been susceptible to Mara in the first place.
So it's your problem for being susceptible to Mara.
That's right.
Yeah, there could be something to that. I mean...
So you should be like susceptible to Mara,
yeah,
for her to infiltrate in such a manner.
Him.
And then Moggallana had Mara in his tummy.
But he recognised him. He didn't let him get away with it. There's something to that. I mean, it's at a certain level, yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, if you can say, well, you know, are the soldiers in Iraq responsible for killing when they shoot, when they've merely been sent there by a government and they don't really understand the issues? But on the other hand, you know, it's your duty to act responsibly and educate yourself as to the issues. I mean, it's difficult when the media is feeding you all this stuff. You can't actually get the information. But if you want to have a look around, you can find it. So it's not 100% either way, I think. In the Abhidhamma, they express this as sankharika and asankharika. They have two kinds of sasankharika and asankharika is two kinds of intention. Asankharika is... if you do an intentional act without prompting, okay, or without being pushed, and then another way, kind of intentional act is if you do it with prompting. So both of them, they can be intentional, but obviously if it's without prompting, if it's spontaneous, then it has a stronger karmic effect than if it's with prompting. Yeah?
And it has a stronger karmic effect.
If it's without prompting. If you do something off your own bat, yeah, then if someone's pushing you and saying, come on, and then it's a kind of a mixed thing. So, now...
It's already pointed out from
Ananya. Yeah. Yeah, and there's more about that here. Right. According to the three Chinese versions, the householders not only abused the monks, but went so far as to beat them with sticks, throw stones at them, and destroy their requisites. When being reborn in hell due to such evil deeds, the householders realized that their evil rebirth was due to having maltreated the monks. Okay? So the Chinese version seems to be a bit more reasonable here, that they weren't actually possessed by Mara, they were merely encouraged by him. And they not only just yelled at the monks and made fun of them, but they actually beat them up violently. Okay? So that's quite a difference.
And yeah. At this stage, it's Moggallana who is Mara.
Moggallana who is Mara, yeah. Now, so that particular passage on the you know, abusing the meditators and so on is found a few times in the suttas as a kind of parody of meditation. So no doubt it was something that was around in the context of the Indian culture. This kind of idea that meditation was a bit useless and a bit of a waste of time, and what are these guys doing anyway? Okay. Then the Venerable One, the Blessed One, Kakusandha, accomplished and fully enlightened, addressed the bhikkhus thus: Bhikkhus, the Maradusi has taken possession of the Brahmin householders. Okay, and thinking that maybe they will abuse the bhikkhus and thereby Mara will make an opportunity. Come, bhikkhus, abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with loving kindness. Likewise the second, likewise the third, likewise the fourth. So above, below, around, and everywhere, to all as to yourselves, abide pervading the all-encompassing world with a mind imbued with loving kindness, abundant, exalted, immeasurable, without hostility and without ill will. Abide pervading one quarter with a mind imbued with compassion, with altruistic joy, with equanimity. In the same way. And so when these bhikkhus have been thus advised, so this is the response if you're getting abused and so on. Then this is the response. And it's very good instructions to remember that, especially for the monks and nuns. And that if you are treated in a way that's unpleasant or disrespectful, and you think, oh, this person shouldn't be doing this, and you remember these bhikkhus in the time of the Bhikkhu Buddha Kakusandha, okay? It wasn't merely a case that somebody didn't, use the right term of address when talking to you, or, you know, offer things to you in the way that you think they should offer it, or give you the right seat when you wanted it in the bus or whatever it might be, but they're actually being badly abused and beaten up even, and still their only response was to spread loving kindness. That's the solution. They did that. They went off to meditate and practiced loving kindness, Brahma Viharas. Then Evil One, the Maradusi, considered thus: Though I do as I'm doing, still I do not know the coming or the going of those virtuous bhikkhus of good character. They're still outside of his control. Let me now take possession of the Brahmin householders, telling them, come now, honour, respect, revere, and venerate the virtuous bhikkhus of good character. Perhaps when they're honoured, respected, revered, and venerated by you, some change will come about in their minds, whereby the Maradusi may find an opportunity. Okay? So this is what they did. And after having honoured, respected, revered, and venerated them, then after the dissolution of the body, after death, most of them went to heaven. Again, raising the same questions as to the nature of the karmic responsibility for that. But, of course, very beautiful thing. This is the more subtle armies of Mara, okay? And again, especially for the monks and nuns to bear in mind that the obvious things that are an obstacle are when you having opposition and all of these kinds of things, but the much more subtle and much more difficult ones to deal with is when one is honoured, revered, and pujyata, mounted, venerated, yeah? And so these are the things which cause the cittasa anyatattang, the change in one's mind, so that one's aspiration to go forth to realise the Dhamma becomes confused or clouded, and one becomes caught up in and starts to enjoy these kinds of way of being treated, so that you're being put on a pedestal and so on. I think this is a major problem for the Sangha, and something which we really need to be very, very careful of. Very careful indeed. So, what did the Buddha say? Come now. He said, come bhikkhus. So in response to Maradusi, he says, abide contemplating the foulness in the body, perceiving repulsiveness in nutriment, perceiving disenchantment with all the world, contemplating the impermanence of all formations. So here, asubha nupassino kaye viharata. So contemplating the asubha, the non-beautifulness of the body, of course being the meditation on the different parts of the body, and could also include things like the cemetery to contemplations and so on. Ahare patikula samnino, the revoltingness of food. So there's wonderful, we've discussed this sometime earlier, there's wonderful descriptions of all this stuff in the Visuddhimagga, and it gives you elaborate and detailed, kind of luxuriously vibrant and vivid imagery on how to examine the revoltingness of food, all the way from having to leave your meditation in the morning and get dressed and, you know, walk out past the novice's vomit in the courtyard and go out and go past the corpses of the dead elephants on the road and you way into the town for alms, and then getting there and coming, going like a jackal to the charnel ground to go and get your food and so on. Very,
dogs vomit.
And then sabaloke anabhirata sanya. So this is the, just the whole world is just not interesting. And when I do this one, I like to do, like, you know, I think of gaffer tape, like old peeling off gaffer tape on guitar cases, and the pub carpets. If you want to get have a look, you just think about it, because, you know, this is what everyone lives for, you know, this is the most exciting kind of thing, you know, drink and music, dancing and all of these kinds of stuff. And then when you're a musician, of course, you go there in the afternoon to do your sound check, so you see these places in the light, yeah, and the ground in beer stains and cigarettes and all of these kinds of things. This is why I'm not going to listen to any requests to have carpets in this monastery. It's just too much for me. So sabaloke anabhirata sanya.
But you would appear to imagine them repulsive.
Yeah, well, you know, there's a kind of spectrum there, isn't there? Yeah. Sometimes in the Buddhist meditation, there's like a movement where if you're very attached to or attracted to something, then you have to really look at the dark side of that first, if you want to get that sense of equilibrium. Yeah. So first of all, you look at the negative side of it, and then later on, you come into more of a balanced perspective. Yeah. So the ultimate perspective is just equanimity, just understanding things. Yeah. And then you come into that balance. But then sometimes, you know, it's like if you want to give up cigarettes or sometimes, you know, you maybe have to do some aversion therapy or something like that. You know, you look at the ashtray and just how repulsive it is, and that helps you to get away from it. And later on, it doesn't matter. You're not worried about it. Yeah. It's not like an absolute, but it's an antidote, as it is in this case. You know, it's an antidote to a particular kind of problem. And then the sabbasankaresu anicchanupassi. This is not, when it's actually described in more detail, it's sabbasankarehi apiyati harayati jiguchati. One is horrified, disgusted, and repelled with all sankaras. Here, sankaras meaning things of the world, basically. So that's the sabbasankaresu anicchanupassi. Okay, now the Chinese versions. Oh, I should go back a little bit. Now notice that this particular passage in the Pali is talking about the lay people venerating is much shorter than when the lay people were abusing. Okay, we had this kind of quite extended passage talking about abusing. The Pali version just says that they venerated, didn't say anything else. The Chinese versions say, and the Sanskrit parallel fragment, so quite a lot. They say they not only offered food, but went so far as to put their clothes and their hair on the road, asking for the monks to step on it for the sake of good fortune. Okay, so that's how they got to heaven. So,
isn't this a practice as well?
Though? Putting the hair on the road.
Hair down on the road. People walk on it, isn't it, in Taiwan?
Some special occasion, they will have all those young girls and then put all their long hairs on the road. And then, like when the Buddha relics arrive,
mm-hmm.
They have this. Very rare, but they have this kind of ceremony to show very, very sincere respect.
And did you ever go and walk on their hair?
Not many.
No?
No.
But do
that. Yeah, once I saw it, it's the Buddha really.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. Very sincere. They have like 50 girls and long hair and spray on the road and the Buddha really passing.
I was just kind of thinking about whether you'd trip over or slip or something. You get all these hands, you'd be embarrassing. Talks about we've discussed this previously because there's a few passages in the Vinayas where it talks about this as well. One of the passages, ironically enough, saying this is one of the reasons why we shouldn't ordain bhikkhunis, right? Because in future time, because now people are so devoted that they will their hair down on the road for the bhikkhus to walk across. But if we ordain bhikkhunis, then they'll lose respect, and so they won't be laying their hair on the road for the monks to walk on. So therefore, we shouldn't ordain bhikkhunis.
Yeah, chicken and the egg theory.
So, it's one which... maybe they might have been, Mara might have been encouraging them to that particular... So, interesting custom, but there you go. Okay, so then they went to heaven. Then, according to the Pali, we have the Pali one there about the instructions to the monks. Different versions are a little bit different. In the Madhyama Agama, he said to contemplate all conditioned things as impermanent, subject to arising and passing away, and in terms of non-desire, discarding, cessation, and giving up. So, less emphasis on the kind of the revolting aspect, and more just on the cessation and anicca aspect. Another individual translation says, contemplate all conditioned things as impermanent, and in a similar way. And another contemplation says, goes from the impermanent nature of all things to the need to avoid greed and delight in regard to this unsatisfactory and empty body when using robes and food. Okay, so there's some slight differences in the presentation there. Then, the bhikkhus then went and practiced in that way. Then, when it was morning, the Blessed One, Kakusandha, accomplished and fully enlightened, dressed and taking his bowl and outer robe, he went to the village for alms with the venerable Vidhura as his attendant. Then the Maradusi took possession of a certain boy and picking up a... So again we have this thing about possession. According to the Chinese versions, I think all the Chinese versions, he transformed himself into a young boy or man in order to attack Vidhura. Okay? So again, whereas the Pali version, we have him possessing the householders and then possessing the boy. In the Chinese version, we have him first teaching and encouraging the householders and then transforming himself. So there's no motif of possession in the Chinese versions, interestingly enough. Yeah, which is the kind of thing that Marad would do all the time, was changing his shape. That's his most common kind of thing. Picking up a stone, he struck the venerable Vidura on the head with it and cut his head. With blood running down from his cut head, the venerable Vidura followed close behind the Blessed One, accomplished and fully enlightened. Then the Blessed One, Kakusanda, accomplished and fully enlightened, turned around and looked at him with the elephant look. This Maradusi knows no bounds. Okay. Na vayang udusi maro matamanya siti. He doesn't know the measure. Okay. And then looked at him with the elephant, and then with that look, the evil one, the Maradusi, fell from that place and reappeared in the great hell. So the Naga Palokitang is the elephant look, the Naga look. So the idea, the literal explanation of it is that one turns around with one's whole body like an elephant. So it means it's like a very significant thing because you're turning around to look rather than simply glancing over your shoulder. But it's mentioned a few times, like before the Buddha's Parinibbana and things like that. Of course, the implication is not that the look made him go to hell. It's simply that his karma made him go to hell, and he looked at the same time. But also as far as karma and so on goes, that notice that in the Pali, you have two cases where he possessed somebody, and in one case, the one who was possessed went to hell. Okay, so the householders went to hell, but in this case it's Mara himself who goes to hell. So, not being particularly consistent. Weird here in terms of saying, well, he's possessed a boy, Kumarakan, and then Mara goes to hell, but what does that mean? Does he sort of extract himself from the boy's body or whatever? It just sort of sounds like he falls down to hell. So, the Chinese version being a bit more coherent here, he's probably made himself into the form of a boy. Okay, so he went down to the great hell. Now, evil one, there are three names for the great hell. Okay, the hell of the six bases for contact, Chapasayatik Niko. Interesting name for a hell, I guess, because you're tormented through all these six senses. The hell of the impalement with stakes, Sankusamahato, being perhaps more obvious what kind of hell that is. And the Pachata Vednio, the hell to be felt for oneself. The idea here being, of course, that you can't offload, you can't, like, there's no hell offset scheme, so you can't sort of... you can't sort of get some poor unfortunates and get them to experience your hell. You have to experience it for yourself. Now, then, evil one, the wardens of hell came up to me, that Niraya Pala. So this being one of the very few occasions in the Pali Canon when it talks about this kind of thing, okay? The Niraya Pala, hell guards, came up to me and said, good sir, when a stake meets stake in your heart, then you will know I've been roasting in hell for 1,000 years. Oh, thank you very much for that information. That's very kind of you. And they used Marisa. Interesting, it's the same, it's a polite terminology, it's used by the devas. So Marisa, when meets Haraye, in the heart, to come together, then Vasasahasang. I've been roasting in hell for 1,000 years. For many a year, evil one, for many a century, for many a millennium, I roasted in that great hell. For 10 millennia, I roasted in the auxiliary of the great hell. Okay? The auxiliary being the Usada, the Usada of the great hell, where the feelings and torments are supposed to be even worse than in the great hell itself. Experiencing the feeling called that of emergence from ripening, apaching wutanimang. So, interesting way of describing hell here.
Very. Have you ever found that in any other religion? That particular, the stakes meeting?
No.
But the emergence from ripening.
Emergence from ripening, yeah.
So that was something that was confounded?
Confounded?
Yeah.
What do you mean confounded?
Was that able to happen, the emergence from ripening?
No, it happened alright. Right. Oh, yeah.
It all ripened.
Yeah, it all happened, yeah. Emergence from ripening. I guess it means, it's hard to say what timing, yeah, hard to say exactly what it means. Pacha is similar to the word for cook.
Apaching.
See, I roasted. Apaching. I roasted. The feeling called, it shouldn't be ripening here, it should be roasting. Apaching, the emergence from roasting. Yeah. Shouldn't be ripening. It's the same word. Can mean either to ripen or to cook something, but here obviously means to roast something. So apaching, so emergence from roasting.
Said to be more painful than the feeling.
Perhaps what it means is you apaching, you roast in the Mahaniraya, then you go to the Usada, the annex or the, you know, something of the great hell, and there you've emerged from the roasting. And you experience the feeling there, which is the emergence from the roasting in the great hell. So perhaps that's even worse. You know, you even think about it in terms of being burnt. Like, if you're actually burnt, it hurts. But actually afterwards, it can actually hurt a lot more. Yeah? So maybe that's what it... Maybe it just relates to that straightforward physical experience. And my body had the same form as a human body, evil one, but my head had the form of a fish's head.
You just think of all the soldiers in Burma. The monks
smashed
their heads against the wall, and what their khan was going to be, all young kids.
Right.
Were ordered.
And
prompted
khan. Yeah, and very involved. Yeah.
Intense.
And very hard for them to get out of that whole thing. I mean, the army's the only out they have. Probably the army and the sangha. Probably the half of them there, well, no, all of them. Imagine all of those soldiers, their brothers, friends, cousins would all be in the sangha. Okay, only the Pali version says this thing about having the human body with the fish's head. The other versions don't have that detail. I mean, again, that's a classic kind of mythic thing. You know, you find, you know, constantly, you know, monsters and gods and goddesses comprised of different kinds of animals and so on. Often taken as like symbolic of a less fully developed consciousness, that you sort of haven't sort of differentiated yourself. You're not fully human. Okay, so then the verses. And these verses found similar versions in all of the... Some versions, the Madhyama Agama version says the question here, the first set of questions here, verse 24, was actually asked by Mara. Okay, he was filled with such fear that he asked the question. Anyway, here's the verses. What can hell be well compared to, wherein Dusi roasted assailant of Vidura the disciple and the Brahman Kakusandha? Stakes of steel, even 100, each one suffered separately. These can hell be well compared to, wherein Dusi roasted assailant of Vidura the disciple and the Brahman Kakusandha? Dark one, you have much to suffer by assaulting such a bhikkhu, an enlightened one's disciple who directly knows this fact. In the middle of the ocean there are mansions eon-lasting, sapphire-shining, fiery-gleaming, with a clear, translucent luster, where iridescent sea-nymphs dance in complex, intricate rhythms. Wow. Sounds good, doesn't it?
Oh, perhaps he's there in the middle of hell.
No, this is just talking about the things that Mahamoggallana knows. So he's giving a bit of a lion's roar here, and saying these are the things he's seen with his psychic powers. And, what are we to think of that? I am one who, when exhorted by the Enlightened One in person, shook Migara's mother's palace with his toe, the Sangha watching. Okay, so this refers to... Oh, where does that refer to? That's
a bit different.
That's in the... I think it's in the Vinaya somewhere. Best one, address the Venerable Mahamoggallana. Moggallana, your brothers in the holy life from the ground floor of the mansion of Migara's mother... scatterbrained. Go, Moggallana, stir up a sense of urgency in those bhikkhus. Yes, Venerable Sir. Venerable Moggallana replied with an evil grin. Then he performed a feat of psychic power such that he made the mansion of Migara's mother shake, quake, and tremble with his toe. That's a bit that I love. I don't care that he makes it tremble, but the fact that he does it with his toe.
His little finger.
Then those bhikkhus, shocked and terrified, stood to one side and said, "It is wonderful, indeed, sir. It is amazing. There is no wind, and this mansion of Megara's mother has a deep base and is securely planted, immobile, unshaking, and yet it shook, quaked, and trembled." And the Blessed One approached those bhikkhus and said, "Why, bhikkhus, are you standing to one side, shocked and terrified?" And they told him. And the Buddha said, "Bhikkhus, the Venerable Moggallana, desiring to stir up a sense of urgency, sangvega, in you, made the mansion of Migara's mother shake, quake, and tremble with his toe. What do you think, bhikkhus, having developed and cultivated what things has the bhikkhu Moggallana become so powerful and mighty?" And of course he goes on to teach these four idipadas. Okay. So the only confusing thing is really that there's more reference numbers than you actually need in the book. Okay, it's more documented than you need it to be. So you just need to know which ones you're actually referring to. So once you realize it's just the Samyutta number up the top here, and then the Sutta number, then it's very easy. I am one who, wielding firmly strength of supernormal powers, shook all of Vajrayanta Palace with his toe to incite the gods. Okay, so this is referring to the Chula Tanha Sankhaya Sutta in the Madhyama Nikaya. Is Moggallana breaking the veneer here by boasting about his psychic powers to Mara?
Well, he's still Mara there, isn't he?
No, now he's Moggallana again. He's talking to the actual Mara in this day.
Isn't that an offence to talk to demons?
Is it?
I don't know, is it?
Is that a veneer offence?
Turn back.
He stopped telling the story a little just there, because he's referring to it, but saying about his rebirth in hell. And so he's giving it back. Is that against the Vinaya? Any Vinaya experts here? Whether it's against the Vinaya to boast about psychic powers to a Deva, you'd think that'd be a bit superfluous if you're capable of chatting away with a Deva in the first place. Trying to reveal your psychic powers is a bit kind of like trying to shut the gate after the horse has bolted, so to speak.
Those things are wood. They all did there.
But they were talking among themselves. It's different, yeah. Anyway, I think that's one for the venue experts. I am one who in that palace posed to Sakha this question, do you know then, friend, deliverance in craving's utter destruction? Thereupon Sakha then answered truly to the question asked him. Okay, so interrogator of the gods. I am one who thought of posing Brahma this question in Sudhamma Hall in heaven. Is there still found in you, friend, the wrong view that you once accepted? Do you see the radiance surpassing that in the Brahma world? Brahma then answered my question truthfully and in due sequence. There is found in me no longer, sir, the wrong view that I once held. Indeed, I see the radiance surpassing that in the Brahma world. Today, how could I maintain that I am permanent and eternal? So this one, reference to Sanyutta Nikaya 6.5. Sanyutta Nikaya? It's a bit harder, yeah. Looking here, number 6.5. Now, on that occasion, the following evil speculative view had arisen in a certain Brahma. There is no ascetic or Brahman who can come here. Then, having known with his own mind the reflection in that Brahma's mind, just as quickly as a strong man might extend his drawn arm or draw in his extended arm, the Blessed One disappeared from Jetta's grove and reappeared in that Brahma world. He sat cross-legged in the air above that Brahma, having entered into meditation on the fire element. Okay, so he's sitting there, burning up with fire. Then it occurred to Venerable Mahamoggallana, where now is the Blessed One dwelling? With the divine eye, which is purified and surpasses the human, the Venerable Moggallana saw the Blessed One sitting cross-legged in the air above that Brahma, having entered into meditation on the fire element. And then he too disappeared from the Jetta's grove and reappeared in the Brahma realm and sat in the air above the Brahma, though lower than the Blessed One, and burning up with the fire element, as did Mahakasapa, Mahakapina. Mahakapina, interestingly enough, if we look in the Bhikkhu Sanyutta, which is here, 2, 3, 7, 13, the Bhikkhu Sanyutta, one of my favourite little collections in the Pali Canon, Bhikkhu Sanyutta, is it Mahakapina? Mahakapina. Now, here we go. This is Mahakapina. Now, we know very little about these people. Right? What do we know about them? Very little. Right, and the Blessed One saw Mahakapina coming in the distance and said to the bhikkhus, "Bhikkhus, do you see that bhikkhu coming, fair-skinned, thin, with a prominent nose?" The world's first ever Western bhikkhu, Mahakapina. Huh? What else does it mean? You obviously he's got skinny because he can't stand the local food.
Tall and a prominent nose. Perhaps he was Greek.
I wrote this to Bhikkhu Bodhi when he was doing the editing. I said, it's got to be the first Western bhikkhu. He didn't put that in as a note. So that's good, isn't it? Sujata. Now, if you insist, okay, the Blessed One saw Venerable Sujata coming in the distance and addressed the bhikkhus thus, "Bhikkhus, this clansman is beautiful in both respects. He is handsome, good looking, pleasing to behold, possessing supreme beauty of complexion. And he is one who, by realizing it for himself with direct knowledge in this very life, enters and dwells in that unsurpassed goal of the holy life, for the sake of which clansmen rightly go forth from the household life into homelessness."
Wow.
"This bhikkhu shines with sublime beauty." Yeah, well, at least I've got the name anyway. Okay, "I am one who by liberation has touched the peak of Mount Sineru, visited the Pubbavidehan's grove, and whatever humans dwell on earth." Pubbavideha being like one of the other lands. This verse refers to Venerable Mahamoggallana's mastery over the supernormal power of travelling in space like a bird. So, I'm not sure if those ones are actually mentioned elsewhere, literally in the suttas like these other ones have. "There has never been found a fire which intends, let me burn the fool, but a fool who assaults a fire burns himself by his own doing." Right? So that's a very beautiful way of putting it, this whole karma thing. It's not, like, it's always put as like a retribution, like from a theistic context, it's a retribution. It's like a vengeance thing, yeah? God's getting vengeance because God or whoever it is, because someone's done wrong. But the point is it's not the fire's fault. That you get burnt. It's not karma's fault that people get hurt by the by their acts, but it's just the nature of karma. It's the nature of cause and effect. Yeah? Beautiful way of putting it. So it is with you, Amara. By assaulting the Tathagata like a fool who plays with fire, you only burn yourself alone. By assaulting the Tathagata, you generate much demerit. Evil one, do you imagine that your evil will not ripen? Doing thus, you store up evil which will last long, O Terminator. Amara, shun the enlightened one. Play no more your tricks on bhikkhus. So the bhikkhu chastened Mara in the Behesakala thicket, whereupon the somber spirit disappeared right there and then. The somber spirit, Lumano Yakko, depressed Yaka. Okay.
It's sort of like Gestalt therapy, you know, where you take the different aspects of yourself and you speak to them directly and really theatrically.
Okay.
Way of subduing, subduing them, because they're having quite a discussion.
Yeah.
And it's not like Mother Lana is maybe boasting so much as really getting into that role play in a way.
Yeah.
And so does Mara
That's quite good, because that's what it is. It's a way of making these things vivid.
Yeah.
Maybe they have family too.
What? Mara and the bhikkhus?
Well,
do you mean do you get fun doing all this kind of stuff?
Yeah, it doesn't mean well, I
can. Oh, yeah.
So are you able to give us a bit of an overview of what we've just covered? Because it really was quite circuitous.
Circuitous?
Yeah.
Ontologically circuitous, or is that...
Ontologically circuitous.
Ah, what have we just covered? Maybe does somebody else want to summarise it? Sorry.
Mara's the baddie, Mahakongalana became the baddie.
Became the baddie? In Paina's past life.
That's tough in hell.
Yep.
And then did some poetry.
And then did some poetry. Okay. Yeah.
You got that?
I know. Okay, very good. It's an interesting sutta. It's quite a relative to most of the suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya. It's quite complex in its presentation. It's like its form. You know, you have they're talking in the present tense, and then he's going back and giving the story in the past life, and then there's different characters involved in different roles, and then coming back into the present, and then referencing also out to other suttas. Yeah, so it's got this kind of interconnections with the different kind of things, but I think the idea, obviously, being to kind of dramatize or present in a very vivid way some of the teachings. I guess the core, really, of the teachings is the bit. I mean, to me, the most memorable part is the bit about where the bhikkhus are going for alms and they get alternatively abused and then praised. And so, for me, this is one of the most memorable kind of teaching things, is to remember these two are two like extremes. Yeah. And so this is something which the Buddha refers to again and again in many important suttas, like the Brahmajala Sutta, that the kind of praise and blame and need to maintain a kind of sense of equanimity around these things. They're like two halves of the same coin. So for me, that's like the theme, that's the outstanding theme of that. Mara as a figure, I think, is very interesting. And I mean, there's so many different dimensions of it which could go into, but just one of them is simply that dimension of disguise, which is also very important. Mara's coming, presenting himself in different forms all the time, so you never know who he is. So this is very important as a metaphor for actually how the world is, that it's not what it seems. Yeah. So to look through the appearances. Yeah. But Mara himself, we mentioned that last week, Mara himself must have a lot of power. So he must have had quite a bit of abilities. Venerable just asked me to read out this one here from the Samyutta on Gains, Honours and Fame. A faithful female lay follower, rightly imploring her only daughter, dear and beloved, might implore her thus: Dear, you should become like Kujutara, the lay follower, and Werlukandakiya, Nanda's mother, for this is the standard and criterion for my female disciples who are lay followers, that is, Kujutara, the lay follower, and Velukandakiya, Nanda's mother. But if, dear, you go forth from the household life into homelessness, you should become like the bhikkhunis Kema and Upalavarna. For this is the standard and criterion for my female disciples who are bhikkhunis, that is, Khema and Upalavanna. And then you should say, while dear, while you are trainee, a seka, that means you're not an arahant, one who has not reached her mind's ideal may gain honor and praise not come upon you. If gain, honor, and praise come upon a bhikkhuni while she's still a trainee, one who has not yet reached her mind's ideal, this is an obstacle for her. So dreadful, because gain, honor, and praise. Yeah, I mean, certainly that's, I think it's a huge issue for the Sangha.